This is a CBC podcast. Ever wonder why our podcasts aren't exactly what we air on the radio? Or what it means to subscribe to a podcast? Or why we don't podcast Wiretap and the debaters? You'll find the answers to these questions and more on our podcasting Frequently Asked Questions page. Just head to cbc.ca/podcasting and follow the link to our FAQs.
A 2,000-liter oil spill at Hibernia last month highlights the concern. Do incidents like this come too close to flying beneath the radar? And selling the seal hunt, a former Greenpeace employee now teaches public relations. What lessons can be learned about selling the hunt to Europeans? I'm John Furlong. This is the broadcast for Tuesday. You know, I first heard about this as a rumor, and then I saw a reference to it on the internet, on the Newfoundland News Group, that there had been an oil spill from a tanker, about 2,000 liters, from the MT Vinland working at Hibernia. So today I called Canship Ugland to find out. Apparently this has been known before. They issued this statement 16 days after the incident. It has been confirmed that the MT Vinland, this is the statement from Canship Ugland, it has been confirmed that the MT Vinland experienced the leakage from the bow loading system during the loading process at Hibernia on February 9th. Canship Ugland Limited reports that there was no oil released into the water. The vessel safely offloaded its cargo at Whiffen Head. The vessel was successfully cleaned without release to the environment in full cooperation with involved government agencies. The cause of the leakage is currently under investigation. Well, although there doesn't appear to be any lasting damage to the environment this time, to birds or to the ocean, there is still a concern that incidents like this fly too close to being beneath the radar and that it's too hard to get information on such happenings. Dr. Bill Montevecchi is a biologist who is active in the study and protection of seabirds. Well, Dr. Montevecchi, let's talk about this incident first of all. When did you first hear about it?
Oh, yeah, probably, I don't know, maybe a week or so after it happened. John, I wanted to say one thing. I think we definitely wouldn't want to infer that there's been no mortality of birds or no mortality of fish. You know, we've documented oiled birds around Hibernia in the past. We don't have independent observers there to look for these things. So I think that's always what we want to be looking for. And I think in this instance, we just simply don't know. But, yeah. So I heard about 10 days maybe after, maybe a week or so.
And am I correct in saying that your concern is that it's difficult to find out exactly what happens in these incidents, that, you know, there may be a reporting channel for the Hibernia people, but it doesn't kind of filter out properly to the public?
That's a tremendous concern, John. And there's been a number of incidents in recent weeks. And, it's absolutely incredible. And even people who might want to, and I would invite any of your listeners or you now to try and get information, you know, to contact the CNLOPB, because, you know, when we had the Husky spill, I'm thinking of White Rose in September. The Husky was in 2004. I'm thinking of the White Rose spill in September. It was incredibly difficult to get information. The media reports, the only media reports actually came from Husky Oil, who said there were no birds. And actually, you know, the media would be interviewing Husky, and they would say there would be no oiled birds. And, you know, that's kind of, it's like calling the Portuguese skipper, you know, out on the nose and tail of the Grand Banks and asking him the mesh size of his mesh. You know, self-reporting is actually not the way we want to be protecting the marine environment. And it's, essentially what we've seen in these instances is either no information or self-reporting.
So how do we change that then? If we need some kind of independent observer, how would that work?
Well, I think we need a courageous government that really, and the CNLOPB, I mean, it's shocking, you know. I would go as far as to say it's appalling, the kind of environmental information that's not accessible from the CNLOPB. I mean, when I've looked at these events in the past, what they sort of do is they reiterate the industry press releases. And, you know, the public deserves to know because, it doesn't belong to the oil companies. It does belong to the public, to the Newfoundland public, to the Canadian public. And, information is just a good thing. So I think it just takes a courageous government that really has the perspective and the understanding that, you know, we're exploiting the environment for oil, we're exploiting the environment for fish, and there's a certain responsibility we have to protect that environment, and that's the part that just doesn't hit the radar screen.
Does it put your mind at ease at all to know that Canship Ugland says that this was contained to the vessel itself and there was no oil released into the water?
Well, we know that they had to bring the vessel in, and you want to realize, too, as I think with the White Rose as well, the vessels get cleaned in Placentia Bay. They have to come into Placentia Bay, and they had to clean the bow. So I guess the position of Penny Ugland would be that it got on the bow, but it somehow stopped before the water line. 2,000 liters, that's a fair bit of oil, and I just think you need independent, I think you just need independent corroboration here. Otherwise, it's very difficult to know what the situation is.
All right, Dr. Mazzavecchi, well, I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Okay, John, I appreciate yours.
Bye.
All the best.
Dr. Bill Mazzavecchi is a biologist who's active in the study and protection of seabirds. Well, the seal hunt has been battered and bruised for years now, and it has been knocked back on its heels. The EU committee has voted for a full ban on all seal products. That legislation will now be sent to the full parliament for a vote. It certainly is a victory for the anti-sealing groups. They have waged an aggressive campaign using bloody images of the hunt to whip up anti-seal hunt venom. But is there any way to counteract that? Have we missed the boat somewhere in our approach to selling the hunt as humane and sustainable? Trudy Richards is a professor of public relations at Mount St. Vincent University in Halifax. Well, Trudy, you offer a unique perspective because you used to work for Greenpeace, so you're pretty well schooled in the art of dancing with the truth to some degree, aren't you?
I guess that's true. Dancing with the truth is certainly something Greenpeace was guilty of when it came to campaigning against the seal hunt way back in the 70s, and I think the organization belatedly learned its lesson and lamented how badly it had treated Newfoundland and Labrador fishers and how insensitive they were to legitimate fishing pursuits. That being said, the damage was done, and organizations like EFAW have picked up the gauntlet and done a fine job of making the seal hunt seem truly outrageous.
Now, how have the anti-sealing groups been able to do that? I mean, the ability to whip up the public almost seems to be an art form that they've mastered.
Well, I don't think we can give all of the credit to them, quite frankly, for the opposition to the seal hunt. That being said, there's no question that the bloody and horrific images of seal clubbing and the blood left on the ice floes and carcasses left behind, not to mention the adorable face of the infant seal pup, regardless of whether that's really the seal that was ever in use, is quite beside the point. Those images have been firmly etched in the minds of so-called consumers, and nowhere more so than in the EU, where a lot of environmental issues have taken front and center more quickly than they have in North America.
And I guess to their credit, and it's dangerous for me to say this, but to their credit, the anti-seal hunt groups have done a remarkable job in achieving what they set out to do.
I don't think there's any question about that, but I want your listeners to also appreciate that increasingly citizens are generally less willing to take advantage of nature, of the environment, in the interests of what many would consider to be a luxury item. And so that's not necessarily thanks to the International Fund for Animal Welfare and others. That just has to do with the thinking public recognizing that these luxury items that are available only to those who are relatively well off as a result of slaughtering or killing another animal, people have begun to realize that that should not be necessary.
So it's just the times we live in, much the same way as the way smoking is viewed by the public as opposed to the way it was 50 years ago.
I think there is a parallel to be drawn between smoking, for example, and sealing. There was a time when smoking was not considered to be unacceptable. In fact, it was a socially acceptable thing to do. My mother was a light smoker all her life, so was my father, and I'm sure that's true of many of your listeners' parents as well. And now we recognize that not only is it inappropriate, it's really bad for you. So I think you can push the parallel a little too far. It's not that sealing is considered in that light. It is more that sealing has become an unnecessary occupation to the extent that primarily what it provides is items for people to put on their backs, as a luxury item rather than as a necessity. I guess that's especially true as the climate warms us.
Is there a way, I mean, as a professor of public relations, is there a way to reverse the trend, to fight back? Is it possible to sell the seal hunt as a humane and sustainable enterprise?
Well, it certainly can be sold as a humane enterprise because sealers don't use the methods that they once did, or they don't use the methods, the clubbing that they once did in the same numbers. And I suppose someone's always going to find a sealer who does do that. But for the most part, their methods are much more humane. And heaven knows those of us who eat chicken or beef have a lot to answer for in the way animals are treated. So there's all that. And I have to say that as an environmentalist, I do wonder about the environmental sustainability of manufacturing all these synthetic products. The manufacture of them and then the disposal of them may well have, arguably, a more lasting negative impact on the environment than the culling of a seal population that is huge, you know, much like the raccoon population, another source of fur coats. There are many more raccoons than we need. And again, you have to argue, well, is this a fair thing, a just thing to do, to kill an animal to put a fur coat on your back? Arguably, in a place like Winnipeg, which is where I'm from, you know, maybe it is. Maybe it's a more responsible thing to do than to use these chemical products that are arguably less sustainable, less environmentally responsible. That's a huge argument for the sealing industry to undertake, I recognize. But truthfully, beyond that, I do not see what other options there are.
Almost like the greening of the seal hunt?
Yeah. If that doesn't sound too much like an oxymoron.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, others may think I'm daft to even float this possibility, but truthfully, I do think there is an argument to be made in that direction. I don't think there's much point in talking about how sealers use the whole animal. I just don't think that washes very much. The most lucrative part of the seal is the pelt, and no one's going to believe otherwise, regardless of protestations to, you know, suggesting the opposite. So I would say that this is the only way to go, but there may be others who have better ideas. That's just one that's been sort of festering in my mind for quite a while.
Now, the other thing, just to get back to the animal rights groups, the fact that they have been so successful and the fact that they have so much money behind their campaign, that puts sealers at odds in terms of it's not really a level playing field, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, it isn't, but then, I mean, you just look at Big Oil or Big Pharma, and they've got way more money than the environmental groups in those areas, and yet the media seem to go to the underdog, the environmental groups in this case, to get a perspective. So maybe sealers are able to appeal to the media, who are always looking, as you well know, for conflict or disagreement or another dimension to a story. You know, it's a possibility. I'm saying it's a long shot, but I don't know what else the sealing industry can come up with other than to, you know, find another way to make a living.
Because the reality is it isn't pretty.
That's right. That is the reality.
Mm. All right, Trudy Richards, well, I certainly appreciate your time this afternoon. Thank you for joining me.
You're welcome, John.
Bye now.
Bye.
That's Trudy Richards. She is a professor of public relations at Mount St. Vincent University in Halifax. Well, what do you think of what Trudy had to say? Our fish line numbers, 576-5287, 1-800-561-3474. Okay, let's have a gawk at the marine weather synopsis. First of all, for Newfoundland, marine interests are advised that freezing spray warnings are in effect for the east coast north of Cape St. Francis, for the northeast coast, Cape St. John and south, the Belle Isle Bank and the Funk Island Bank. For Labrador, marine interests are advised that freezing spray warnings are in effect for the Labrador coast, south Labrador Sea, western half, northwest Labrador Sea and the east Labrador Sea, northern half. And for the Maritimes, a ridge of high pressure will remain quasi-stationary over the Maritimes tonight. Moderate to strong northerlies ahead of the ridge diminish to light to moderate winds in its vicinity. On Wednesday, a low-pressure system will track from northern Ontario into Quebec. Winds increase to strong to gale force southerly over all waters as the system approaches. And that is your marine synopsis. Well, I've been looking for a reaction to the cod assessment as outlined by DFO last week. Last night we heard from a couple of people on the south coast who fish in 3PS. The outlook in 3PN4RS is not much better. The abundance of cod, according to the assessment, the abundance of cod is near the lowest level in the historical record and increasing very slowly, if at all. Jason Rose fishes that way out of St. Lunaire on the tip of the Great Northern Peninsula. Well, Jason, what did you think of the cod assessment that was released last week by DFO?
Well, we know that's wrong. I mean, back in there, too, you could already get a cod eaten. You know, it's now you can put a net, you know, your sand ring on a pair of net. So.
Yeah. So you think the numbers are higher, do you?
Yeah, we know they're a lot higher.
Where do you fish, Jason?
At a Great Bra.
Right. In 3K?
In 3K.
And so you had no problem getting your quota last year?
No, we were on a couple of days when the fish picked up during this. Wasn't much fish on the first bit there, but the little nor'easter kicked it up there a bit, and there was good fishing there.
What about in other areas up your way?
Same thing everywhere. I mean, up there, there's, you know, put in the almost anywhere tall now, so you get the 500-600 pound of fish or more.
Now, in the Gulf, they say things don't look so good.
Yeah, fish is even thicker in the Gulf than it is there.
Is that right?
Yes.
Well, what do you think? I'm at a loss to explain why DFO would say that there's, or not know, there's as much fish as you say there is. I mean, is it because they don't do enough science or what?
They want some more money for doing science from going around, you know, just waste it like they always do.
Yeah.
They'll probably be talking about St. John's, you know, so. They come here in November, not for cad. I mean, you know, it's too late.
So they do their work at the wrong time, you think?
Yeah, or if they do any work at all. You know.
Jason, what kind of year are you expecting this year?
Hopefully it's going to be a little better. It looks like we might have a buyer for doing some toad crab stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't. Nobody buys toad crab up your way?
No. Hopefully down cats might buy some deer because they're involved with biotics, so hopefully it's looking that way right now. I don't know for sure, but.
What are you waiting to get now, crab?
Crab, yes.
Yeah, so when will that start?
First part of June, yes.
Right. And tell me, Jason, what kind of year did you have at the crab last year?
Well, crab was good last year. I mean, everybody caught the crab in the after trips the year before. It was really good, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, price was pretty good, so.
Yeah.
I mean, he's more cod. I mean, you know, there's definitely there for the kit, so why don't they give it to us? I don't know what they're saying to her. And now, I mean, anything after the seals, I mean, that's only going to, you know, seals are going to eat it all anyway, so just buy for weed kits and make a few dollars in it.
Mm. That sounds like a newborn in the background, is it, Jason?
Yes.
How old is it, a boy or girl?
A boy, so.
How old is he?
He's 3 months, so time to eat, so I'm not to go out. I don't know what it's going to.
Yeah. Would you want him to follow in your footsteps in the fishery, Jason?
Not like it is now, but if the somebody might smarten up, you know, get Danny Williams and his bobbleheads in there to. They're smarting up, you know, they're just like a bunch of bobbleheads going around saying, oh, you know.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about the fishery.
That's Jason Rose. He lives in St. Lunaire on the tip of the Great Northern Peninsula. You're listening to the broadcast for a Tuesday afternoon. Well, you know, if you ask my wife, I am a meat and potatoes kind of guy as far as the eye can see. I don't like much that's exotic. I don't like much that's wild except fish. My wife likes to quote me as saying, if it doesn't have Sobeys or Dominion stamped on it, I'm not interested. So count your lucky stars that you're not me, because there are people out there who love new things, new tastes. That's one of the benefits of our global community. The food fair has gotten a whole lot more interesting. The new Coleman store in Corner Brook opened about a month ago with something truly unique for those parts, sushi, an exotic import from Japan. Now, sushi always sounds raw fishy to me. But recently, Dorothy King broke free of the fashion police, put on a hairnet, and joined the store's sushi master, Kevin Vincent, at his workstation.
Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Dorothy. How are you today?
Well, I'm as happy as eaters come, because I have been waiting for sushi to come to Corner Brook for a long, long time.
And me too. Yeah, me too.
And you didn't start this here. You were where?
I lived in B.C., British Columbia, on Vancouver Island for 5 years, and I used to go to sushi restaurants with my wife for about 3 times a week. So when we came back in 2001, there was obviously no place to eat sushi unless you went to St. John's. So we start doing it ourselves.
What is it exactly? I mean, people wonder. And the only thing that tends to come to mind when you ask people is, oh, that's raw fish.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's not just raw fish. I mean, it started out as raw fish. It started out about 4,000 years ago. The Japanese needed to kind of cure their fish. There was no refrigeration. So they did something similar to what us Newfoundlanders would do with fish. We would use salt, let's say a layer of cod, layer of salt, layer of cod. But the Japanese were using rice. Rice was so plentiful, so a layer of rice, a layer of fish, a layer of rice, and leave it for 3 or 4 months, and it would cure. Take off the rice, discard the rice, and they would eat the fish. And so it would ferment, it would help ferment the fish and cure it. But we don't do that process here. About 400 years ago, as gentlemen in Japan came up the way of rolling the sushi with fresh rice and also fresh raw fish or cooked fish. And here at Coleman's, what we use is mainly cooked fish. So it's not all raw. And I can do a vegetarian roll, so it's all straight up veggies. I can do a California roll, and you have cooked fish in that, which is your crab meat, right, Alaskan pollock. And as soon as we get into the crab season, then we're going to look at getting some fresh crab and use fresh crab from our Newfoundland waters.
Let's look at some of the ingredients that you have arrayed here. What have we got?
Well, we start over here on our left, and we have some yellow and red peppers, okay? But don't go all in every roll, but mainly in the BC roll and also in the veggie roll. Then we have English cucumber cut in thin strips, okay? We have asparagus, so blanched asparagus. We put that in our veggie rolls and some special rolls. And then avocado is one of the main ingredients in most of our rolls. We go through a lot of avocado.
Now, you can't eat sushi without a couple of other ingredients, and one of them is a real trip-up for a lot of people, and that's the wasabi.
Yes, wasabi originally is a Japanese horseradish. And it's very spicy. It's hard to get just the Japanese horseradish. So what we use, it's also wasabi. It's a horseradish, and there's a little bit of a mustard seed in there as well. The whole thing behind it is you take a little bit at a time. Don't put the whole piece of wasabi in your mouth because it'll pretty much clean out your nasal passage pretty quick and give you a good shot, your eyes water, and it's fun to watch somebody else take it.
Well, the first time I ate sushi, my daughter said to me, Mom, breathe in through your mouth and out through your nose. In through your mouth, out through your nose. Okay, let's make some.
Okay. So what we're going to do here is we have nori, which is seaweed. It's a very thin sheet of seaweed. And we place rice on our nori. So we use a medium grain rice. And the big thing about sushi is that your rice has to be perfect. In Japan, I think it takes about 3 years to learn how to make the perfect rice.
How long did it take you?
10 years. And I still don't have it perfected, but it's definitely a certain kind of art to it. And it can't be too hard or too soft. It should fall apart in your mouth when you put one piece of sushi in your mouth. So.
And it's got to be sticky.
And it has to be sticky rice, exactly. Not too sticky, though.
Now, you've taken this sheet of nori,
yes,
with the rice, and the rice is actually face down.
Yes, this is called an inside-out roll. So when sushi came over to North America, some people found that it was a little more difficult biting right into the nori itself. So what's a really good seller here is the inside-out rolls. So we put the rice on the outside, and we sprinkle some toasted sesame seeds on it. It gives you a really nice taste. And then what we do is we put our ingredients inside. So I think what we'll do is we'll go with a straight California roll.
Oh, no, wait a minute. This is going to be my sushi.
Oh, okay, yes, okay.
I get to tell you. Maybe I'll make up something
okay.
new.
Okay, what would you like today, Dorothy?
I would like some avocado.
Alrighty.
And some of that crab/pollock.
Yeah.
Can I have a piece of asparagus, too?
Yes, I can throw that in there for you,
and
for sure.
And some color, maybe some pepper.
All right.
What is it that you like about eating this stuff?
Well, for one, it's all fresh ingredients, you know. You basically get a salad in a roll with your fish in there as well. So it's fresh, it's crisp. It's that Japanese-type sushi experience with the chopsticks and the miso soup and the, you know, the green tea and the nori and the, you know, so it's all one, and it's very clean, very healthy. And for one small roll, it's about 100 calories, so you're not, it's pretty hard to gain weight on sushi.
So I can eat all I want.
Yeah. It's not like your traditional Newfoundland meal where you got to go lie on the couch after you after you eat it and have a nap. This one here, you can eat a lot of sushi and still walk away without unbuttoning that button, you know what I mean?
So, but you may not be able to walk away if you imbibe a little sake with it.
Yeah, well, yeah, you could stagger out the door after that one. But sake goes well with sushi, that's right. So sake, if people are wondering, it's a fermented rice, kind of like...
Rice wine.
Rice wine, exactly. So you wanted asparagus as well, Dorothy?
Yeah.
Alrighty, and some pepper?
A little bit of pepper, just for some color. How about some red?
Yeah, you bet.
Time to roll.
All right, so we can roll this one up.
He's going to make this look very easy. There he is. He's tucking it all in to the bamboo.
Tuck it in. Here we go.
Wow, perfect.
So then I'll take my knife and I dip it in some water so the knife don't stick to the rice. There's three things with sushi. One is, we'll say more like senses, is one is the look of it, the appeal, presentation, so the color, we'll say. And two is the taste. And the third one is the texture. So, you know, you can get a crunchy or soft texture in there. So it's almost like a party in your mouth.
This is 8 pieces. How much am I going to pay for that?
This one here is $7.99 for 8 pieces. So that's definitely your lunch right there for sure. So then we'll put a little bit of wasabi. You like a lot of wasabi? It's up to you how much you want to put on there.
Oh, teeny bit more.
Oh.
Teensy
bit. You like wasabi, eh?
Okay.
There we go. And ginger. Now, the ginger is a pickled ginger, and the ginger is there to cleanse your palate. So what you do is you take a little piece of ginger, put it in your mouth, and swish it around, kind of the roof of your mouth and your tongue. And
okay, Kevin, enough talking. It's time for the eating.
Okay, all righty. So you need to drizzle a little bit of soy sauce over the top of your roll, and I'll just hand this one to you. You want to use the fingers? Fingers are fine, hey?
Okay.
You want some wasabi on there?
Yes, I do.
A little wasabi.
Down the hatch.
Down the hatch. Cheers.
Cheers.
Mmm. Delicious.
If he doesn't say so himself, folks. Thanks so much.
You're quite welcome, Dorothy.
That's Kevin Vincent. He's a master sushi maker at the New Coleman store on O'Connell Avenue in Cornerbrook. And thanks to Dorothy King for that. Now, don't forget our fish line numbers, 576-5287, 1-800-561-3474. If you want to drop me a note, the email address is fish@stjohns.cbc.ca. Don't forget the Springdale office, DFO, licensing service, unavailable tomorrow. If you need help, you'll have to call the office in Grand Falls, Windsor. That's the broadcast for today, Tuesday. I'm John Furlong. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.